I'm Rose Matiso.
I'm Katie Auth, and this is High Energy Planet, the podcast from the Energy for Growth Hub about new ideas to solve global energy poverty.
On today's show, Tisha Shula, founding CEO of Edmonton Energy, which helps energy companies implement sustainability and decarbonization strategies. She also serves on the boards of the Energy for Growth Hub and the Breakthrough Institute. Tisha's current work focuses on helping oil and gas companies figure out how to play a leadership role in the transition to a low-carbon economy.
So why did we invite Tisha on the show? Tisha approaches energy poverty and the energy transition in a way that's very different from anyone we've ever had on the show before and from most people we know. Her backstory, which we'll talk a little bit about today, was really an immense journey, and I think that's going to surprise a lot of people. She started out as an environmental activist, and then she pivoted to playing a leading role in the oil and gas industry. So she cares deeply about climate and getting to a low-carbon future, but she believes that oil and gas can and has to play a leading role in getting there.
Tisha has described the energy transition as long, fraught, complicated, and expensive, and we agree. We do have major questions about the O&G industry's capacity to lead, which we'll get into in this conversation. But no matter what, the energy transition will require more engagement across fraught political divides, and there are few people better equipped than Tisha for these kinds of conversations. All right, welcome, Tisha.
I'm so glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
All right, so let's go back to the beginning. Can you tell us something about where you grew up and one thing about it that shaped who you are today?
Sure. I grew up in Tucson, Arizona. People think of Tucson one way today, but when I grew up there, I grew up at a high school with a 50% graduation rate and I was the only one in my class that went out of state to college, for example. A girl I admired who was 4 years older than me had at one time told me that she wanted to go to Stanford, but she didn't get in. So when I was a freshman, I said, oh, well, then I'll go to Stanford. I had no idea. I didn't even know where Stanford was or what it was. By many, many miracles, I ended up getting to go to Stanford on a scholarship. And it left me with the power of magical thinking. Sometimes I and others, we critique magical thinking, but I actually had this very early formative experience that magical thinking worked. And so there's almost nothing you can talk me out of, like in the sense of like, no, like if we put our minds to it, like the whole hippie manifesting thing, which I'm kind of allergic to, I also completely buy into. So when we like today, when we talk about these intractable problems, I cannot resist thinking, yeah, but we'll just overcome them with the power of our passion.
I went to Stanford. All things are possible.
Right. Like me, I went to Stanford. Yeah. Like, and people always used to say like, oh, I think they made a mistake when they let me in. I was like, they didn't make a mistake. Like, let's do this. Like, let's do this. That's how I felt.
Does that girl know that she inspired you and your whole future trajectory?
No, I've never been able to find her. She was like the older sister of someone. And it's the funniest thing. I'm sure she's wildly successful somewhere out in the world. But no, that's a great idea. I should actually like now we have the internet, which we didn't have then. So I can probably solve this.
I'm surprised. I'm impressed that you've waited all these decades to do some like internet and Facebook stalking of this person. So.
Well, you know, it's a funny thing. I don't really think of it, but the question, the prompt made me really think about like, what's like the number one formative thing? And that's probably it.
Well, okay, I have one last thing on this thread is when in the 90s, when I was a kid, my dad went to a conference in Tucson, Arizona, and came back with like conference swag, like a bag. And just like me and the neighborhood kids running around, you know, looking at this bag and being like, how do you say that word? Like, what is this word?
Tucson.
It's like the T and the U and the S and the C. It's like
Tucson.
Where is this so magical land?
I'm not kidding. That is my earliest memory of your hometown.
So Tisha, we teased it a little bit for the audience in the beginning, but I want to talk about this kind of crazy journey that you went on. You started off deeply engaged in the environmental community, and then you ended up leading Colorado's Oil and Gas Association. And you know, I think most people typically think about those two communities as being diametrically opposed and would find you moving from one to the other like pretty shocking. So what was the spark that motivated that shift for you? And what was it like to move from one world to the other?
It was a very long, slow slog that I think all my critics would say is incomplete, whether you're an environmentalist who critiques me for working with oil and gas or an oil and gas person who critiques me for being too much of a climate hawk. Probably the earliest move was I was working as an environmental consultant, and I got a project to go travel all around the country and teach environmental 101 classes to oil and gas field workers. It was a 2-hour class that I designed. And, you know, being a good hippie in Boulder, Colorado, I was like, I'm going to go help these like people understand what we need to do to protect the environment. And I spent 2 years traveling all over the country, going to very, very rural places. And I quickly learned that, first of all, like protecting your local environment is intrinsically important to every single human. There's no, like, there is no political divide about that. And I also quickly learned to translate my sort of hippie language into the words that resonated depending on where I was. If I was in rural Louisiana, that might be one thing. If I was on the plains of Kansas, that might be another. But you sort of learn pretty early to chameleon into like, well, how can they hear me? But also how could I be respectful and not come in like, I know something you don't know. I was also 25, 26 years old. So it was also, I wanted to be respectful.
And you were probably talking to a lot of men.
Yes. I mean, probably 99% of men. It's funny. I don't remember that because it was so normal. I would go in with either donuts or fishing lures just to like, not be, or lottery tickets to just not be received like totally hostily. What I got out of that was just a deep understanding that to make progress on environmentalism, a huge part of it is being deeply respectful and finding common ground with everyone's intrinsic motivation to protect the outdoors, to protect their place where they live. You can pretty quickly find common ground on protecting the planet. Like if you can use respectful language that you can find resonates with people. So that was the beginning of the journey. There are, you know, of course, many, many, many pivot points, but that I understood that the best work could be done in this translation space.
It's translation, but it's also like code shifting.
Yeah. One of the things I know now about myself, you know, 30 years into this work is that I can chameleon like nobody's business, but it's not an inauthentic chameleon. It's not a manipulative chameleon. It's like, if you sit me down, like I've been a vegetarian since I was 16 years old, so more than 30 years, but I have a project with cattlemen now. And when I sit down with them, I will eat a steak because I love them. I love who they are. I love the pride they take in their work. So it is code switching, but it's like, I don't know, like I really transport myself into that world and I mean it. And then it's the task on me then is to be consistent because I do mean it, but I need to figure out how to be consistent as I proceed in my work. So it doesn't seem like I'm flip-flopping or being manipulative. Mm-hmm. That's actually my biggest challenge in this kind of work.
I think this recasting a chameleon role as not a negative thing is really interesting to me. And actually coming from my background in Africa, just from a young age, you have to be many things in many contexts. So I was talking to your uncles from the village, talking to the church women who come for tea with your peers, like, you know what I mean? There's this natural sense of you just have to kind of shift depending on the situation. And I think moving to the US and realizing that a lot of people find that inauthentic was quite surprising. So I think I really value this idea that in our relating and with people and this relational role that we have to kind of do this dance. So that's super interesting. Continuing on this thread, you occupy this really interesting role, mediating between opposing sectors in the energy sector. And you started your company, Edmonton Energy, focused on addressing conflicts between energy developers and stakeholders, from anti-fracking activists to skeptical regulators. And this has kind of been a continuing thread in your work. So what is the most important thing you've learned about building trust and common cause in high conflict contexts?
I think what I've learned that is most impactful to me and my, I think that when I can be effective is understanding how important an individual's worldview is. So Rose, you were talking about how you had to do that your own chameleoning. And there's a natural thing that you did, which is my uncle comes from this environment and the world looks like this. Mm-hmm. And therefore, to be respectful, I need to engage in this way. that's how I try to engage. So I now vary just first sort of first principles. If I walk into a room, who's this audience? What does the world like look like to them? What would be a takeaway that would be impactful? How could they leave here saying, I have received something useful to me? And then engaging from there. So I think the worldview one occupies actually determines so much now of what people can hear, how they're willing to engage. And understanding that has allowed me in some instances to have a superpower, right? To make connections where connections seem impossible. But on the other hand, again, back to the same theme, it can be perceived as inauthentic. Like, oh, you're telling them what they want to hear. So the magic piece of this, the discerning piece of this is to do so authentically. It's not that hard to do authentically if you can find deep respect for the people with which you're engaging. Even if you disagree with them wildly, you can find respect for their humanity, their interest in doing the right thing, for the way that they believe they're on the side of right.
Yeah, this is actually making me see your work in an entirely new way, because we've talked about these issues before outside of the podcast, but I always thought of it as like, oh, Tisha's deeply strategic and she can change her language and her approach depending on the context, and that's awesome. But now what I'm hearing is it's actually a much deeper personal connection that you make. So like before, when you were saying you transport yourself into the position of the people you talk to, it actually sounds like you just have deep, deep empathy for an empathy in the sense, not that you're sympathetic to them, but that you can actually occupy their position and see the world from their vantage point. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah, that's true. And there's a few pieces I'll just layer onto that I've learned over the years. One is if I'm uncomfortable in a situation, like I have a defensive or reactionary feeling about someone or a situation I'm in, I query that within myself. My goal isn't like, I don't like what they have to say. My query is, if I'm uncomfortable, I'm not listening well enough. I'm not understanding. If I'm taking offense, I am not understanding what they're trying to say. I'm not understanding what's motivating them. And so I try to move toward discomfort within myself in order to understand. A mantra, right, of course, is seek first to understand. So I don't go in trying to change minds. I don't go in trying to get A, B, and C across. It's like, if I need to understand, and if I do understand, then I can engage. If I don't understand, then I try to spend all my time in inquiry, listening, learning, be a student of this person. And the more uncomfortable I am, or the more they push my buttons, the more I put the burden on myself to grow. I need to grow here. Because if they're pushing my buttons, I haven't done my work. So I'm going to do my work. And I'm going to try to get to a place where whatever they say, I can meet it for what it is, their best. They're offering me their best.
Does that get tiring? It sounds exhausting.
So for me, it's energizing. You know, everyone has different things that suck their energy, like glad handing, networking. I can't stand that stuff. Put me in like a fraught room where we need to solve something like that's existential. I'm like, oh yeah, I get energized by that. Put me in like a group that we need to come to a decision that seems impossible. I am energized by that. I think that's very personal. With my team, you know, we have a dozen people on the Adamantine staff. I try to be really mindful that this is not what everyone was born to do. This is not. So we try to create some sort of like frameworks and strategy. We're not therapists. We're not facilitators. So we try to put in some frameworks of like, this is how we engage and make it a little more clinical. But personally, it's very emotional. It's very spiritual. It's very tied to what gives me purpose.
This is so cool. And actually, just one more thing on this thread. And Katie, I love that you brought the kind of empathy into this conversation, because I think a few years ago, I think we kind of reached peak empathy. This is when like Harvard Business Review is like, are you a manager? Be empathetic. Like, this is how you win at business. And everyone, like parents were like obsessed with, how do I teach my kid empathy? And I found that an interesting conversation, because it's great that people are thinking about empathy as a thing that's critical to life and business. It's kind of something that comes from experience, from living in different worlds. And actually, you know, I think there's research that talks about like actually reading a lot of fiction is a really great way for kids to have empathy. And I just wonder, because your whole professional career has been inhabiting different worlds and perspectives. So do you feel like that muscle is getting stronger? this daily practice in empathy that isn't just like the HBR listicle, like I want to be effective. And so I'm going to find the shortcut to be a more empathetic person.
Yeah, I think you're right that what I'm practicing is empathy, but that's not the words I use for myself. My words is respect. And maybe that's like a dated, maybe that's like a generational term, but when I say respect, what I mean is I see you, whomever you are, as an individual who believes you are doing right in the world and is doing the best you can. And actually one of our go-tos when we're frustrated with our team, Adam and team, is everyone's doing the best they can given what they know. Like if you just start there all the time, every single person is doing that. So if they're an individual human, they believe they're on the side of the right, they're doing the best they can given what they know, my job is to see them. So maybe that's empathy, but for me, it's respect, because I think our intractable polarization, our intractable teams that we get on, comes out of this sort of dehumanizing, and so much can be solved just by humanizing. And for me, the pathway to humanizing someone, particularly if I don't want to, that's why I put the burden on me. if I don't want, the more I don't want to, the more the work needs to be done, is respect, to show respect.
I want to move on to the next question, but part of me is also, I hope we can weave in the R-E-S-P-E-C-T song to give a soundtrack to this. I love that, respect. It'll be the anthem of this episode. But anyway, speaking of intractable problems, quote unquote, intractable problems. So your recent work has focused more on working with ONG companies to set and implement real decarbonization strategies. So what does real decarbonization mean to you?
It means two things fundamentally. One, it means decarbonization activities that are credible, that are moving the needle, that are so that in different contexts, that can mean different things, but scalable, actual investments, not just pledges. So real decarbonization is things happening that are accelerating progress. That's the first definition. The second definition, though, is pragmatic. Real decarbonization is not just talking about solutions that are fashionable, but talking about solutions that are scalable and doable given the constraints of politics or economics or physics. The reason I put an emphasis on real in these two elements is because I think when we can create conversations that are based in respect and seeking common ground, those two things are the things, those two ingredients are the ingredients that are often missing at the table. You know, if there's like, you know, good guy, bad guy, do this, don't do this. If you get around, okay, but let's can we agree what real means? And can we agree that progress is our shared imperative? Then it makes more room for solutions. And whether that's, you know, in the US or in a developing economy, I find that the conversation can be a bridge if introduced respectfully after trust is established.
One big question that I had as I was reading about your work in real decarbonization and the various companies that you're working with is just trying to play out and understand how you envision this pathway like 50, 75 years from now. Because right now there are companies that are, you know, working to reduce their emissions intensity, or they're, you know, diversifying their business by investing in renewables alongside oil and gas. But like, what do you envision those companies being in 100 years? Are they doing a totally new business? Are they using carbon capture to cancel out their emissions? Like, what is your ideal future for them?
This is something we spend a lot of time talking about in the industry, because several of my clients are companies that existed 100 years ago. And so there's this visceral thinking of what happened in the last 100 years and what will happen. What do we have to do to be the energy delivery system of the next 100 years? And essentially, the core component of that is innovation and flexibility and responsiveness to disruption. The answer isn't decarbonization centric. Any company that has existed for 100 years that wants to exist in 100 years has to first and foremost be thinking about how flexible they are to disruption, the way energy consumers want their energy, the expectations of policymakers, shareholders, employees. Now, decarbonization is one of several demands that these companies are facing today. It's central. When I imagine the energy system of the future, I'm imagining one that is nearly emissions free, that is almost unrecognizable in terms of delivery systems, like just that, like we can't even imagine today what our little electric power, nuclear powered teleporting machine is going to be or whatever. And so the companies that meet that reliability, affordability, and flexibility are going to be those that are the most nimble. To me, at the heart of the next 100 years question isn't climate. The heart at the next 100 years question is like responsiveness, of which decarbonization is one, but maybe not even the hardest. Like if you really think about nuclear, just transforming energy delivery systems, oil and gas becomes like very quickly on a 100-year timescale irrelevant. So that's the kind of thing, like, well, I love to think 100 years, but that's not where I spend most of my time.
Yeah. Well, I was just going to say, it's really interesting because on the one hand, like you're very focused on pragmatism, which to me means like, okay, what can be done today in the real world? But then to hear you talk about like a blue sky future, you're also thinking about this totally different universe that we can't know what it looks like. And that's just a very interesting dichotomy.
Yeah. One of the reasons that I can do that is because I strive to speak the language of my audience. Very forward-thinking energy executives are thinking like that. So introducing decarbonization as like one of the myriad disruptive demands of a 100-year-away future is like very non-threatening, right? It's not politicized. It doesn't make you evil. It's not, you're not the problem. You're not allowed to be at the table. It's like, who's going to win the race to the next 100 years? That is just a unifying mindset. That just, like if we all spent our time in that space, we would be expending so much less energy on the fights of today and on the innovation of tomorrow. That's where I would love to be. That's not the reality of our political system, but I find it a very unifying opportunity to think in those terms. For those who are open to it, understanding the prosperity that the oil and gas industry of the last 100 years allowed to the present. Of course, we talk a lot about the burdens of carbon in the atmosphere, but just understanding the transformation that has been made possible by all the historic legacy energy systems creates also that foundation of respect that allows you to have different kinds of conversations.
So this is so interesting because, and I do really appreciate the way that you're trying to connect now, which is where I think that, you know, we really are agree that it's complex and this is a system we have now. Let's be pragmatic. Where things start to fall apart and where the rifts show between the communities is building that long-term future. And so I think this is a really constructive way to try and tie them together. My follow-up question is a bit about, because you work with these companies day in, day out, and I get that at a high level, they want to survive and be relevant into the future. But what is like one or two things that a company can do to be ready, to be nimble? And it's one thing to say like, be nimble, be responsive. Like what are, like when you're working with them, what are like concrete things? And, you know, when I think about, for example, pharma companies have this model where you can be big, massive companies, but you just have this acquisition model where you're just swooping up all of the Harvard and Oxford and Stanford. And I'm trying to name all UT. I'm trying to be fair with all the schools I'm naming. researchers, you're scooping up, you have this model where you can absorb innovation. And that's kind of how that industry is set up. And what is the strategy for energy companies that are set up so differently to be nimble? Like what is like a concrete thing that you talk to companies about?
My third book, the last book I wrote was exactly a playbook for this. Well, the second one was called The Playbook, but the third one was actually provided in The Playbook.
More playbook.
It lays out four trajectories, and I won't bore you with the trajectories, but I'll just give you a couple examples. One trajectory a company can align in is to figure out how to be the low carbon energy deliverer of tomorrow. And so that means what we recommend is that companies invest in oil and gas adjacent solutions. So use your core capabilities, your core infrastructure, your people. There's over 1 million oil and gas workers in the US. So it's this idea of repurposing to accelerate the energy transition. Examples of oil and gas adjacent solution include things like geothermal using historic oil and gas wells to provide electricity, or moving low and no carbon liquids and gases. That could be hydrogen, renewable natural gas, things like that. So companies are making literally billions of dollars of investment in the US on these oil and gas adjacent solutions. It's a way to provide proof points, but also to stay in their lane in a way that's, I think, credible and also can be successful. Because if we want to accelerate solutions, then companies ultimately will have to be responsive to their shareholders, to their employees, to their fiscal responsibilities, while at the same time decarbonizing. And so those are just a few examples of how companies do this work.
Super, super helpful. And we look forward to the future playbooks that help us kind of drill, because it is a little bit of a moving target as like circumstances change. We need to keep, as you said, be nimble and changing tactics. Your work has largely focused on energy issues in Colorado and the United States. And so why did you join the board of the Hub, which focuses on energy issues in emerging and frontier economies?
Earlier, you asked me about my journey from environmental activist to oil and gas. So when I was at the Colorado Oil and Gas Association, I went into that. I started there in 2009, and I was unapologetically an environmentalist who thought they could make the oil and gas industry better. And then I quickly found myself with the responsibility of representing 40,000 families in the industry, which, because of this deep respect piece, I really took seriously. But it became quickly clear that being an environmentalist who worked in oil and gas was just not flying out in the world. So I decided to do a deep dive into, can we get off oil and gas today? And if we can get off of oil and gas today, I'm going to quit this job and go work for somebody else and fight against the oil and gas industry. Because I'm sort of mentally nimble like that. I'm willing to do that. So I spent a couple months really looking into, can we get off oil and gas today? The issue that rose to the top, that as it does for all of us who work in this space, is that it's the developing economies that are going to need oil and gas in order to reach a middle-class lifestyle. Now, in 2009, that was like kind of an unpopular, unexplored concept. So I sought to build a network. It's how I ended up connecting to the Breakthrough Institute, where I sit on the board. I started following the work of Todd Moss, who was like this weird guy who put out these tweets that you know had refrigerators in them. It was all part of my journey to hold myself accountable to making sure that if I'm going to work in oil and gas, I need to be accountable to making sure we're doing that piece of it. That was my interest. And then it developed into a real passion. I've had the opportunity to travel all around the world to get to consult on projects or on this topic. And so it's deeply important to me. When we're done solving domestic polarization around climate in the US, then I'm going to go work on that.
Yeah, easy peasy, right?
We're almost there. Give me a couple years.
So one thing I struggle with, Tisha, like you know from talking to us in other contexts, Rose and I have gone through our own, you know, emotional considerations of how we think about oil and gas and climate and energy poverty and these issues that are often really, really challenging to kind of work through what's right, what's moral, what makes sense. And we have our own skepticisms about the oil and gas industry's capacity to lead in this way that you envision. And we know that sort of skepticism is not unfamiliar to you. In fact, it's deeply familiar. I think you've written broadly about addressing that skepticism and kind of navigating it. Why do you believe it's so important to keep doing this work, even though so many people on both sides kind of dismiss the voices of the other? And like, are you seeing any demonstrable progress in closing those gaps?
Yeah. I wrote my first book, Accidentally Adamant. I'm obnoxiously like pinging my own books, but I wrote it because my sister-in-law, who is also my best friend, kept saying, why is fracking okay? Like, I love you, but what? I wanted to go on the journey for myself, but also for others, of can we live without this stuff? And if we can't live without this stuff, then let's move on. Like, we can live without tobacco. Let's move on. And so that was my journey there. And the reason I keep going is because in my work, the conclusion I have come to, which I think everyone has to come to for themselves, because I did write a book about it. And while it convinced, 100 people, it did not convince 100 million people. We all have to go on this journey of, can it be done without A, B, or C? Can it be done without coal? Can it be done without oil? Can it be done without natural gas? Can it be done without companies? Can it be done without whatever? And my conclusion is, if you actually prioritize decarbonizing the energy system and or either one, you prioritize raising billions of people out of poverty around the world, either one of those, but certainly with both of them, it cannot be done without mobilizing the forces of the oil and gas industry. And that is my personal conclusion. And therefore, I want to get to work and I want to help everybody on both sides of this debate. My life work happens to be bringing the industry to the table in meaningful, incredible ways. That's my calling of the moment. I could see a parallel universe where I was doing that on the other side. Like, we need to make room for the oil and gas industry, but someone else has to do that. And then I get to like make sure we're ready to show up when invited. So that's why to me, it's like a no-brainer. It's what I was born to do. I wake up with a ton of energy for it. Every time someone tells me no, I just think, well, you're wrong. So let's go.
I'm really glad we've had this conversation because I think it's one that we need to keep having. Because I think I'm hearing you and I kind of get it, but I'm still skeptical. But I think part of the disconnect again is this, like, I get it, where we are now. This is powers 80% of our economy. ONG makes our lives happen. And I get that. And we have to start with this, these are the facts. And so it's just continuing to iterate with you and with everyone about how we get from point A, which is where we are, and to be honest and sober about this is where we are. And then build out the journey to point B, which is zero emissions. It's obviously something that all parties need to talk about and kind of build the car as we're moving. And I think that that is a thing that's difficult. That is a thing to kind of figure out, is how it's hard enough to build the baseline and be like, this is the reality. This is the pragmatic reality. Let's face that. And I think that's one thing that we really valued, having you kind of do that. Like, let's be sober-minded. And I think that the journey that Katie and I are on, and that a lot of people who are skeptical are on, is, okay, we get this is where we are. We get it's going to be difficult. Like, how do we map that out? And it seems that you map it out as you go and you keep building in these chunks as a starting point.
Yeah. One thing that helps when it's possible to introduce, and this is a mini step process also, is if we recognize that by vilifying energy sources, by vilifying energy industries, we're just removing our options. It's wasted energy. And there's a lot of people who very credibly argue about how industry deserves A, B, and C. I'm just so relentlessly future focused that it's sort of like, well, yeah, go to therapy, work it out, and like, let's get to work. I feel like we're expending time we don't have arguing about things that are not particularly pertinent to the task at hand.
We promised our audience when we started off that this is going to get people thinking in like really interesting directions, and you always deliver. So this has been super, super interesting. And this point of how can we talk to each other is so important. So thank you for like that role you play. I know it cannot be easy. So we're now closing the interview after covering many topics, from Aretha Franklin's Respect to how do we build this impossible future, just to kind of close on a reflective mode. So looking back, what's the one thing that has changed the most about you since you started this work?
This is such a great question. I have more courage than I used to. Even things I've said to you here today that I know members of this audience will just not like at all. I have more courage because even though my position is less popular than it's ever been in the 20 years I've been working in this inner space, I believe it's more important than ever before. So in some ways, I can provide cover for others to live in this middle ground by being a little bit out there, I believe the stakes of the status quo polarization, the stakes of the two sides, are just too high. And so I am braver than I used to be. Like, I wish I could say, oh, I don't care if people critique me. Like, I actually have like the soft heart of like a little bunny rabbit, but and everything hurts me and I cry a lot. I just am brave now because I have some finite amount of time left and I want us to make progress.
Rose and I were already talking today about how we should just own the fact that we cry a lot, and it means that we care a lot about the world and we care about issues, and we shouldn't see it as a, a weakness. So I appreciate that.
You can't be brave if you're not scared. You can't be courageous if you're not easily hurt. So those things actually go hand in hand.
Okay, Tisha, so now it's time to play Short Circuit, which is a fun, punny name for a rapid-fire round of questions. Really quick, don't overthink it. Let's just run through it. Boom, boom, boom. It's a lot of fun. So are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay, cool. So what's one thing that people often get wrong about you?
That I'm mean.
What? Who would think that?
What? I hear I'm scary. Right, a lot. I guess I kind of am scary, so maybe they don't get it wrong. But you told me not to overthink it.
Also, what? Okay. Rapid fire. We don't have time to drill into this, but audience, I don't
we'll
know.
We'll revisit.
Yeah.
Okay. You have to complete the sentence. The energy sector needs more blank.
Women.
Hmm. I get most nervous when?
That I have to go to the bathroom on the airplane. It's true. I'm afraid of delays.
And I want to learn more about?
Oh, everything, but probably quantum physics.
Yeah, that's not ambitious at all.
No. Oh, goodness. I think we need to have like a separate podcast episode where we just bring back all the guests and like drill into their short circuit answers. Just leave a lot of questions unanswered. Okay. All right. So if you weren't an energy wonk, what would you be?
A barista.
A Boulder, Colorado barista.
Yeah, because like you go to yoga and then you read philosophy and I kind of want to do all that.
I feel like that market is probably saturated, but
I know. But you told me not to.
Some career advice for you.
Yeah.
Okay, last one. What's one podcast or book or song that you can't stop thinking about?
Oh, well, it's none of those, but I'm watching Succession. I'm self-medicating with red wine and Succession
right now. Oh, it's so good.
You know what? I just want you to know, compared to Succession, I'm a really good person and I have no problems.
That's our wrap for today. Tisha, thank you so much for being on the show. As always, you know, it just really gets us thinking every time we talk to you. It gets us thinking, feeling, wrestling. And I think that this is what conversations should be about. And one big goal for our podcast this season is to not just do the preaching to the choir, talking to the choir, to actually like have conversations that are expansive for us, for our audience. And I'm sure that our audience members really, really appreciated this and learned a lot from it. So thank you so much. And let's keep the conversation going.
Thank you for having the courage to have me. It's just, I just love everything you all do. I'm your biggest fan and I'm honored to get to contribute in any small way.
That's it for today's show. High Energy Planet is a production of the Energy for Growth Hub, matching policymakers with evidence-based pathways to a high-energy future for everyone. Find out more at energyforgrowth.org and share your questions and thoughts with us at Energy for Growth on X and LinkedIn.
And if you like today's episode, be sure to rate and review the podcast and tell a friend about us. Bob Lawlish is our executive producer and Audrey Zenner is our senior producer. Join us next time for High Energy Planet.